to anyone. It's all about random hookups and having fun. You hang out with different guys every weekend. You don't do the same boring stuff with the same guy. Commitment is for, like, people who don't know better. Chet didn't get the memo, she finished, her mouth all twisted and wicked. I'd heard enough. Originally, I'd thought Lacey had a valid point in leaving Thunder Basin and Chet behind. She couldn't be expected to put her future on hold for him. But after hearing her talk, I was firmly on Chet's side. Lacey didn't feel bad about hurting him. Worse, she was talking crap behind his back and putting him down to build herself up. I hoped he wasn't in love with her still. She wasn't good enough for him. I was about to walk away when Rosie the Riveter said, "Don't be so sure of yourself, Lacey. Maybe Chet has moved on. You should ask him to his face instead of talking trash behind his back."
"Jealousy isn't very attractive on you, Dawn," Lacey shot back.
"Who asked you anyway?" Dawn shrugged and walked off, but the smug little smile on her face never wavered. Inwardly, I sent her a high five. "Who would go out with Chet now?" Lacey said to the remaining girls. "He knows you guys are my friends. He's gonna have to get his butt out of Dodge if he wants any lovin'." Now I'd really heard enough. Striding past her, I shot her a black look, but she was too busy laughing at her put-down to notice. I walked to the kissing booth and leaned an elbow on the window. "Happy to see your lips haven't fallen off yet," I told Chet. I eyed the donations jar, which was crammed with bills. "Looks like you're in the lead for Mr. Hot Lips." Pastor Likens, who was standing nearby, perked at my words. After confirming we didn't have any extra ears bent our way, he said in a hushed but excited voice, "He's raised over $100. That's double what the first two kissers earned combined, but don't tell anyone I said so. We don't want to bruise any egos." He chuckled. "Suffice it to say, Chet is the star of the show." Chet shrugged at me as if to say, "You can't argue with the facts, ma'am." "And to think he tried everything humanly possible to get out of volunteering when I said this would be the perfect place for him," Pastor Likens pointed out. Chet gave me another shrug, but this time the tips of his ears turned pink. He was the only guy I knew who could pull off modest and not be annoying. If anything, it made him more attractive. It was hard not to appreciate a guy who had a sensitive, vulnerable side, even if he tried to hide it.
"I haven't seen you in line yet, Stella," Pastor Likens said. "I can't vet Chet as a kisser, but for what it's worth, I haven't seen one unhappy customer."
To my mortification, I felt my face warm. Was I blushing? Why was I blushing? I'd had no problem blowing off kissing Chet before. But something had changed. I didn't know what. Damn it, I was blushing. I fiddled with my earring. "Oh, well, actually..."
"Stella's saving her money for Theo," Chet provided. "He got the last time slot, and everyone knows that's a disadvantage, because by now most people have spent their money. She wanted to make sure he had something in his jar."
I cast Chet a look of sheer gratitude. He tipped me the slightest nod.
"Good thinking, Stella," the pastor said.
He checked his watch.
"Looks like your shift's over, Chet.
Now, where is Theo?" Shielding his eyes from the setting sun, he searched the crowd.
"Can I get you a drink?" Chet asked me, coming around the booth. "I think they've got fruit punch and lemonade at concessions."
Why not? I clearly needed something to cool me off. "Thanks for saving me back there," I said once we'd walked out of Pastor Likens' earshot. "I don't know what came over me." He flashed a lopsided grin.
"I guess if there's only one girl at church who doesn't want to kiss me, I can handle it."
I laughed, relieved he wasn't going to push the issue, and made a concerted effort to hide from my expression any hint that he might be wrong. I didn't want to kiss him. I really didn't. I had a boyfriend, a serious one, and I was committed. The concessions table was picked over, only a few cups of punch and crumbled cookies left.
I boosted myself onto the table and nibbled one of the cookie pieces.
I heard, Lacey is here.
Chet watched me as he sipped his lemonade.
Who told you about her?
Small town. News travels.
I could tell you I'm over her, but I'm not sure you'd believe me. No one else seems to. Whenever she comes home, everyone watches me closely like they expect me to crumble.
Does it hurt to see her?
Hurt?
He shook his head no.
But it flings me into the past. Takes a moment to remember I'm not back there anymore.
I understood with eerie perfection. When I was struck by flashbacks from that night, they yanked me back to Philly. No amount of reasoning or common sense could convince me I wasn't there. I just had to wait it out. In those instances, time couldn't move fast enough.
She's pretty, I said.
He shrugged noncommittally.
But she's kind of bitchy, too.
I flipped a palm up before he could protest.
Just saying.
I don't think she feels comfortable when I'm around. She knows some people blame her for the way things ended between us, even though it was inevitable.
I didn't tell him that she seemed perfectly comfortable making him the brunt of her jokes.
I always wanted red hair like hers, I said wistfully. He elbowed me affectionately.
I like your hair the way it is.
I could feel him watching me, could feel the pull of his eyes. He smelled earthy and enticing. Warm, golden light glinted off his dark curls. He was leaning back against the table, his hand not far from mine. He had amazing hands, strong and tanned and calloused from outdoor work. They were hands with purpose, the kind of hands a girl might dream about. When I could avoid his gaze no longer, I saw something restless in it, and I struggled to not let it get to me. He was breaking down my barriers. This slowly building heat between us was trouble. I had to end it. But it was Chet who broke the moment, not me. With the familiarity of an old friend, he broke off a piece of my cookie and popped it in his mouth.
I should get home, make sure Dusty's not causing trouble.
And with that, he left. As I watched him drive away, I couldn't stop thinking about him. I realized I must have known there'd been someone in his life.
He was too good-looking to have gone unnoticed by girls. As far as I knew, there hadn't been anyone since Lacey. Despite the talk around town, I knew he was over her. When he saw her, he hadn't looked wounded. Startled, yes. Jerked into the past, yes. But not damaged. And that made all the difference. I could think of another reason he'd moved on, but it made me uncomfortable, so I brushed it aside. Deciding to make an honest man out of Chet, I went to find Theo at the kissing booth. He was slumped on the stool, misery etched in every line of his face. He wore a pink bow tie that matched his flushed cheeks. When he saw me strolling over, he ducked his head and hid his face behind his hand.
"Hi, Theo," I said brightly. "How'd you get roped into this?"
"My grandfather volunteered me," he mumbled. "You don't happen to have a cyanide capsule."
"I left it with the KGB when I resigned. Sorry." He dabbed his brow with a pocket square.
"I still have 20 minutes of this torture."
Seeing the empty donations jar perched on the window ledge, he snatched it and shoved it by his feet.
"I want to help the women's shelter. Really, I do. But not this way. I could have donated something I'd sewn.
A men's jacket. They could have auctioned it."
I opened my purse. "Put that jar back up here so I can add my donation."
Theo blinked at me in surprise.
"But I'd have to kiss you." "You want me to kiss you?"
"If you're going to be direct, well, yeah, I do.
But, well, you know, I'm...
He cleared his throat, the flush deepening.
"Theo," I said gently, "it's, well, it's awkward, isn't it? I mean,"
he leaned closer, eyeing me intensely as if he could transmit information directly to my brain.
"Do you really understand what I'm trying to tell you, Stella?"
"Theo, we're friends. Are you going to kiss me already?"
He scratched his cheek awkwardly. I guess I could do that.
I leaned forward. He leaned forward. He closed his eyes and brushed his lips tenderly across my cheek.
That was the nicest kiss anyone's ever given me, I told him honestly. Now put that jar back up here so I can donate.
With a sweet, almost bashful smile, he returned the jar to its place.
I dropped a handful of bills into it, everything I had, and watched Theo's eyes widen with astonishment.
Stella, what are you doing? You can't...
I can't guarantee you'll be the next Mr. Hotlips, but it's enough to beat Trigger by a landslide.
Theo came around the booth and embraced me tightly. His was also the nicest hug I'd ever received.
The following week, I was about to clock out after my shift when Eduardo, the head cook, stopped me on my way out.
You got a minute, Stels?
I couldn't remember the exact day he'd given me the nickname, but it had stuck. All the cooks called me Stels now. Stels Bells, Stelly Belly, and Stello Mello were variations, but I didn't mind. They beat Hey New Girl, which was what I'd been forced to answer to the first night on the job.
Sure. What do you need? I asked.
Deirdre left early. Sick kid. Asked if I would refill her napkin dispensers. Think you could grab me a stack of napkins from the storeroom?
Deirdre was a full-time waitress with two kids in daycare. She usually worked days but picked up a night shift now and then. From what I'd gathered, she'd worked at the Sundown since Dixie Joe opened its doors over 10 years ago. I was surprised she'd asked Eduardo to restock her tables and not me or Innie, who'd taken off a couple of minutes ago. As far as I knew, the cooks never helped waitresses with their tables, and I'd never seen Deirdre and Eduardo hang out during breaks. But obviously I'd missed something. It sounded like they were friends, or at least on friendly terms.
No problem.
The storeroom was at the opposite end of the kitchen from the cook station, and down a narrow set of wooden stairs. I'd been to the storeroom several times before, and while it had the musty smell of damp concrete, it was always cool, and I welcomed any opportunity to escape to it from the heat of the kitchen. I flipped on the light at the top of the stairs and jogged down the wood planks. At the bottom, I rounded the corner and groped blindly for the light pull chain. There were no windows in the storeroom, and at night it was as dark as you'd expect a hole in the ground to. The solid blow to my stomach knocked the wind out of me. Pain exploded everywhere, a sharp, excruciating sensation that left me wanting to writhe on the ground. I never got the chance. A pair of hands rammed me hard against the drywall. The shelves overhead rattled, and warm breath hissed against my cheek. My vision blurred gray. I was still stunned from the hit, fighting to breathe, let alone scream, when he slapped his hand over my mouth. His damp skin reeked of leather and salt, baseball glove and sweat. He snarled in my ear, and in the pitch-black space, the sound did exactly what he intended it to. I shivered in absolute fear. He felt my shudder and laughed softly. Next thing I knew, pain blazed across my jaw, a sharp snap to my neck, and I went down on the floor gasping for breath. I screamed, but the door at the top of the stairs had fallen shut behind me, and any noise I made was cut off when his boot drilled into my ribs. The air went out of me a second time, and my palms and elbows licked fire where I'd donated some of my skin to the floor. He kicked me again and again. I coiled my arms around my head and tucked my chin, but I couldn't protect the rest of my body. Intense pain seared through my legs and back. Each kick felt like a knife to the bone. Gulping air, I finally got a blood-curdling scream out. It rang off the storeroom walls. Someone upstairs must have heard it. Thinking someone would come running any minute, I found my courage and bucked my legs wildly against his assaults. My foot collided with something solid, and he swore viciously. His hand came out of the darkness, slapping my ears hard enough to make my head ring.
"That is how I want to see you from now on," he whispered harshly. "Head down, minding your own business."
I lashed out, fists flying wildly, but he'd already backed out of reach. I heard the stairs creak under his weight. He climbed at a leisurely pace. I understood. He wanted me to know he wasn't running away and he wasn't scared. He could stroll into my place of work and beat me up 10 feet under my boss's office. He could find me anywhere. Fading into the pain, I dimly noted that his feet landed on the steps at irregular intervals. It sounded like he was limping. Had I struck his leg? I felt a flicker of grim satisfaction, and then the door at the top of the stairs opened, casting a slant of light into the darkness. I squinted, watching his tall, broad-shouldered silhouette slip through the doorway before I was once again consumed by darkness. My head lolled on the cement floor. I fought the haze of unconsciousness. I wouldn't have minded the blissful relief from the pain, but Dixie Jo would be locking up soon. She'd never notice my bike propped against a tree out back. She'd see the empty parking lot, assume we'd all left, and take off herself. I'd stay here all night, in this horrible darkness tasting blood. With a moan, I rolled onto my elbow. The pain was so excruciating I was past crying. I drew short, shallow breaths, alarmed by the strange gurgle that seemed to come from my lungs. Was something broken?
Eduardo!
I wheezed his name, wincing at the knife-edged pain it caused to rip through me. In agonizing shoves and heaves, I crawled toward the stairs. He'd spared my arms from the beating, and I used them to drag myself up. I had no idea how I'd ever managed to climb to the top. I couldn't stand. My hips and back throbbed, and a wave of nausea surged through me. Swallowing, I ordered my stomach to calm. If I were sick now, I might pass out. No one would find me until the diner opened tomorrow. I felt weak, delirious. I knew it, and it made me cold with fear. Focus. Tears stung the backs of my eyes. Don't you dare give up, Estella. Was I strong enough to throw a can of sugar against the door? Would anyone hear it? I would not stay down here all night. He'd battered and bruised me violently, but I wouldn't give him the satisfaction of knowing he'd kept me cold, terrified, and isolated through the night. Footsteps. I heard footsteps. The doorknob twisted, and light spilled down the stairs. Eduardo breathed a slew of startled curses. In a fog, I heard the stairs rattle as he rapidly descended them. He knelt beside me, laying a quivering hand on my shoulder. I faintly noted his wide-eyed and sickened astonishment, his warm brown complexion turning squeamishly pale. He shouted over his shoulder. He was yelling at someone to call the police. I heard him rub his hands repeatedly over his thighs, drying the sweat. For a self-proclaimed tough guy, stamped head to toe with menacing tattoos, he was handling my condition worse than I was, I dimly observed. Of course, I hadn't looked in the mirror yet. On the ambulance ride to the hospital, I released myself to the haze. I remained awake, but not alert. I sent my mind to a separate place. I saw flashes of images, but I felt no response to them. Blankly, I registered the paramedics leaning over me, working quickly. Behind them, I saw medical equipment, tubes and monitors. Again, no reaction. In my numb and disoriented state, I heard fragments of commands, followed by concise responses. Nothing broken. I heard that and felt some tense, quivering part of me relax. If nothing was broken, I'd be okay, wouldn't I? They gave me something for the pain, and once it dulled, it was easy to sink into nothingness completely. Carmina arrived at the hospital shortly after I did. Dixie Jo must have called her. I couldn't remember telling the paramedics who to contact. I still hadn't memorized Carmina's phone number. I should do that, I thought dimly. This was never going to happen again. I'd see to it. But, just the same, it was good to have someone to call in an emergency. Swatting aside the curtain, Carmina strode into the exam room. She looked as grim and formidable as I'd ever seen her. I wasn't ready to talk, so I turned my head away.
Understanding the gesture, Carmina focused her attention on the on-call doctor. Instead of flying into hysterics like my mom would have, she kept her cool, weeding out information like a seasoned cop.
What's her condition?
Bruised ribs, mild cuts, swelling.
Have you given her something for the pain?
Lortab. We'll send her home with a bottle of 10 tablets to get her through the next 24 hours, and a prescription. She's going to be tender for the next several days.
I was told this happened at the Sundown Diner during her shift. Have you heard anything about who was involved? Who attacked her?
It occurred to me that Carmina might think there'd been a breach and that Danny Belando was behind this. But this wasn't the work of Danny's men. I had no doubt who'd done this.
Where's the officer handling her statement?
Carmina continued to press the doctor. I haven't seen anyone from the department yet. They should be here soon. Why don't you pull up a seat by her bed? I'll have a nurse bring you...
Coffee? I don't need coffee. I need the damn police department to send over someone to take her statement. I want them out there looking for the individual or individuals responsible for doing this to her.
At the whip-like anger in Carmina's voice, a strange warmth seemed to build in my chest. Gratitude and relief. She'd take it from here. I put that worry out of my mind, and for the first time since arriving at the hospital, I felt a semblance of peace. Carmina would see to it that I was taken care of. A second figure, a tall, dark-featured woman in trousers and a silk blouse, ducked behind the curtain and into the exam room.
Carmina, she said. Grace.
Carmina stood, shook the woman's hand.
I'm glad they sent you. Was hoping they would. I'm sorry. So very sorry this happened. Tell that to her,
Carmina said, nodding in my direction.
Stella, this is Officer Oshiro. I worked with her for a few years before I retired. She's a good cop. She's cross-trained to investigate any type of crime, including assault. She's going to ask you some questions. Let me know if you need a break at any point.
I sat up, leaning into my pillow. I'm feeling better. And I was. Now that Carmina was here, bossing everyone around, the chaos and confusion didn't feel so overwhelming.
Even so.
Her eyes focused on Officer Oshiro, and with a businesslike nod, she gave the go-ahead. Hi there, Stella, Officer Oshiro said, speaking in that gentle but serious voice adults adopt in a crisis. What happened tonight? Walk me through it. Be as detailed as you can. I explained how Eduardo had asked me to get him napkins from the storeroom, how my attacker had waited for me at the bottom of the stairs, how he'd kicked, punched, and slapped me.
He
talked to me. He said, this is how I want to see you from now on, head down, minding your own business. I swallowed, unsure if the tingle in my fingers was from anger or the trauma of reliving the event in words. With perfect memory, I recalled his husky, loathsome voice. It sent chills down my spine.
Did you see his face?
I was on the ground covering my head while he kicked me. I didn't dare lift my head to look at him in case he kicked me unconscious.
Did you notice anything distinguishing? Like what he was wearing? Maybe a watch, a tattoo, or a specific pair of shoes?
The lights were off. The storeroom is underground and doesn't have windows. It was pitch black.
Any idea who'd want to do this to you?
Trigger McClure was the first name that sprang to mind, and I told her so. Carmina and Officer Oshiro locked eyes. Carmina nodded, and I got the feeling they'd just shared an entire conversation. One that didn't discount my suggestion that Trigger was behind this. Officer Oshiro said,
What makes you think Trigger would want to hurt you?
He threw his drink on me last week at work. He was mad because I wouldn't change his order after it had gone to the grill. I gave him a piece of my mind, and I don't think he liked that either. Carmina's mouth pinched.
You didn't tell me, she said disapprovingly,
and I felt a twinge of guilt. I had made it a point to tell Carmina as little as possible. In hindsight, maybe I should have told her about Trigger. But I didn't think it would have prevented tonight's attack.
I never would have guessed he'd go from throwing his soda at me to assaulting me. I doubted even Carmina would have seen it coming.
Sounds like the two of you had a conflict, Officer Oshiro said, still speaking in that gentle, understanding voice. I bet it made you pretty mad when he dumped his drink on you.
He's an asshole.
Stella, Carmina warned.
What? It's the truth. I faced Officer Oshiro. After he doused me, he took off without paying. Dixie Joe, my boss, had to go to his parents to get the money for his meal. The following night, I saw Trigger bully a kid at the Red Barn. Trigger was pressuring the kid to give him free beer. He was also, obviously, drinking, so I called the cops.
You guys. Needless to say, I don't think it really warmed him to me.
You think he was humiliated enough by those two incidents that he decided to beat you up and put you in your place? Officer Oshiro wanted to know.
I think Trigger isn't used to being around a girl who does something besides stroke his ego or feel flattered by his advances.
Another brief glance passed between the officer and Carmina, and both their mouths pressed into a grim line of what I believed to be agreement. Apparently, Trigger had made a name for himself as something other than a baseball star. I brushed my hair off my forehead, cringing when I accidentally touched the edge of my swollen eye. I'd had a black eye once before during a game of crack the egg on a trampoline. I'd been 8, and clearly time had done a good job of erasing my memory, because I didn't remember it hurting this much. The dull pang of a headache was beginning to settle behind the blackened eye. Carmina handed me a fresh ice pack, and I dabbed it gently against the swelling.
She said, "How long did he beat you?"
"A minute or two. It happened quickly, even though it didn't feel that way at the time."
"And then what happened?" Officer Oshiro asked.
"He left. He didn't run. He wasn't scared, he made that clear. He walked out leisurely. But I got a good solid kick in during the attack, and I must have hit him in the leg, because he was limping. It slowed him down."
Officer Oshiro wrote that down on her pad.
"How do you know he was limping?" "I could hear it. His gait was uneven. He favored one leg."
"And after he limped out?"
"There are 3 doors out of the kitchen. The car hop door, the swinging doors that lead into the dining area, and a back door we use to haul trash bags to the dumpsters. I'm guessing he used that door. Eduardo was in the kitchen. He must have seen something. The door to the storeroom is easily visible from the cook station, where he would have been."
"Same Eduardo who called 911? Officer Oshiro asked, quickly jotting down more notes.
"Yes. I'll touch base with him on that. Meanwhile, any other details from the attack stand out to you? Did the attacker say anything else?"
"He laughed." I shuddered unexpectedly as the snarling timbre of Trigger's voice drifted through me. "He thought what he did was funny, that I deserved it." It felt good to wake up in my little twin bed at the top of the stairs in Carmina's house. For the first time, I appreciated the familiar creak of the mattress and the hot sunlight streaming through the curtains. The room smelled like freshly laundered cotton and wood floor polish, and the smell was so much better than the sterile, recycled air pervading the hospital. I pulled myself up to sitting, doing a quick inventory of my aches and pains. I was bruised all over, purple blooms splotching my legs, abdomen, torso. Deep down, I was hurting, but the medicine, blissfully, masked the worst of it. Carmina knocked and stuck her head inside. With a large lap tray held between her hands, she was forced to gesture with her shoulders.
"I thought you might be hungry for a bite of breakfast. Should I leave it on the nightstand?"
A bite of breakfast included pancakes, eggs, hash browns, bacon, cubed honeydew and cantaloupe, and a tall glass of OJ. Carmina cooked meat and potatoes at nearly every meal, but this breakfast took things to a new level. I'd never seen her make so much food at once. And all of it for me. It had been a long time since I'd felt fussed over. The little girl inside me missed how my mom used to sit at my bedside and touch her cool palm to my fevered head.
At the far reaches of my mind, there were still those memories. They were foggy, but they were real, which made them that much more painful to remember. It's true, what they say. You know keenly, cruelly, what you're missing after it's gone. Thanks, I said, clearing away the Walkman and cassette tapes from the bedside table. I was growing strangely attached to Van Halen, and usually fell asleep listening to their greatest hits. The cassette tape's audio quality was abysmal, but the music was decent. Anyway, it was good replacement music. I refused to listen to my favorite bands from home. Estella's Life in Philly and Stella's Life in Thunder Basin were two distinct entities, and I didn't want overlap. Estella had an inner jukebox that played fresh, undiscovered voices over and over until the lyrics became etched on her heart. When she left Philly, she wrapped her favorite songs in a box and placed them high out of reach. A wishful part of me still dreamed I'd get to go back and be her. I'd take down the box and let the music soar freely. But it could never be more than a fantasy, and with every passing day, the dream faded a little, and reality brightened. Estella was gone. Stella was my future. Carmina set down the tray, then lingered by the window. She exhaled, as if she had something on her mind and was debating the wisdom of letting it out. Chet stopped by this morning, she finally admitted somewhat stubbornly, and with that ever-present touch of disapproval. What did you tell him? That you were sleeping, and he should come back later. Does he know what happened? Yes. I sat up taller. You told him everything? All of it. When you didn't come home from work, I called Chet to see if he knew where you were. He didn't, and it worried him that I didn't either. He offered to help look for you, she said with an aggravated sigh. He came over, and that's when Dixie Joe called to say you'd been attacked and were at the hospital. I told Chet to go home, but I suspect he tried to see you. He would have been turned away because visiting hours were over. She gave a fussy shake of her head. He brought flowers this morning. Daisies and sunflowers from his mother's garden. She planted the daisies in the backyard years ago, and they've spread like weeds. Hannah Falconer always had the prettiest flowers. She trailed off, her eyes gazing vacantly out the window. I'd like to go see him after breakfast. I'll walk over so it won't inconvenience you. Carmina's eyes snapped back to me. Walk? In your condition? Dr. Simpson said I should walk if I felt up to it, and I do. I know you're anxious to see Chet. But don't overdo it. He said he'd swing by later. I really want to talk to him now. I need someone to talk to. I have to get this off my chest so I can stop reliving it. When she turned back to the window, her chin turning up with a hint of pride, I knew I'd hurt her feelings. Something had happened at the hospital last night. Some of the animosity I'd built between us had eroded when Carmina strode into the exam room, determined to take care of me. My opinion of her had risen a notch, and I think she realized it. And while she might think we were in good standing now, I wasn't ready to confide in her yet. She'd have to accept that. I ate the pancakes and two strips of bacon. I showered and dressed. I was too sore to flat iron my hair, so I pulled it back in a simple ponytail. But even that was slow going and painful. I skipped makeup, opting only for a light swath of lip balm. The doorbell rang. Thinking Chet had saved me from walking to his house, I slipped on my sandals and walked stiff-legged from the room. I was coming down the stairs gingerly when Carmina opened the front door. She left the screen intact, keeping a barrier between her and the uniformed officer standing on the porch. Morning, Roger. To what do we owe this pleasure? Her voice was pleasant but not quite genuine. It held an underlying sharpness, a touch of suspicion. The officer tipped his hat at Carmina.
I'm here on business.
Business? What business? He cleared his throat.
The matter of Stella's statement,
Where's Grace Oshiro?
She took Stella's statement. This is her case.
Chief assigned me to the case. I'll be handling things from now on. Thought we could have a nice conversation here instead of a formal interview at the station.
Interview? What on earth for?
Just double-checking a few facts.
Last I checked, a fact is a known truth. What's to double-check?
Roger cleared his throat again.
Mind if I step in?
Not at all. But first I'd like to know the exact nature of your visit. Seems to me this conversation,
she put just enough emphasis on the word to make it sound like a euphemism,
might be better suited for the station, with our lawyer present.
Chuckling uneasily, Roger said,
There, there, Carmina. No need to bring out the attack dogs. We're friends, you and I. This is a courtesy visit. I thought the three of us, you, me, and Stella, could sit down and review Stella's statement from last night. Keep it friendly, of course.
Of course, she said coolly.
Roger scratched his cheek, clearly uncomfortable.
Still got a jug of that sweet basil lemonade you make lying around?
Matter of fact, I do, but I'm saving it for company.
Aw, come on, Carmina, don't be like that.
How should I be? Naive? I know what you're doing here. You forget I spent 5 years on the force with you and another 15 with your father. You want Stella to retract her statement. You don't want us to press charges. Go on, admit it. It's a sticky mess for the department arresting a promising young baseball star for assaulting a girl. Now tell me, does Chief Hurst still fish with Trigger McClure's daddy Saturday mornings?
Come to think of it,
don't they hunt pheasant in the fall and watch Sunday night football at the chief's house?
Color splotched the officer's cheeks.
It's her word against his. We talked to Trigger, got his side of the story. He said he accidentally spilled his pop on Stella at the Sundown Diner last week, and she'd had it out for him ever since. She follows him around trying to trip him up. She followed him to the Red Barn last week and made up a story about him trying to steal beer.
Up until now, I'd let Carmina take the reins, but I wasn't about to keep quiet a moment longer.
He said that? I exclaimed, furious. And you believe it?
For the record, he dumped his soda on me, intentionally, after I insisted that he pay for his food. And every word I told the officer at the Red Barn was true.
Carmina's eyes took a definite edge. Stella saw Trigger threaten that boy at the Red Barn, and the boy corroborated her story. You have two solid witnesses. What's really the problem?
In her statement last night, she told Officer Oshiro she's positive it was Trigger who assaulted her. It's a hefty allegation.
Roger rocked back on his heels, standing taller. His sloping belly made the buttons on his shirt strain. He looked to me like a peacock strutting with importance.
It's ruffling a lot of feathers, and before I go forward with this, I just want to make absolutely certain.
Any other kid and you wouldn't be circling back,
Carmina cut him off.
We both know Trigger did this. It isn't the first time he's been accused of hitting a woman. Remember the teacher? You shipped her off to a new school at mid-year and told Trigger to play nice next time. I'll tell you what the problem is. This is the first time that boy has faced the risk of being accountable for his actions, and nobody wants to deal with him throwing a tantrum.
We should have taken him into custody the first time the teacher called 911. We're no different from the parents in the grocery aisle who give their toddler whatever he wants to avoid a scene.
The officer looked more irritable by the moment.
I spoke with Trigger about the assault. He says he was at home when it happened. His parents concur. We've got nothing that puts him anywhere near the Sundown last night. Like I said, this is coming down to he said, she said.
Carmina chuckled softly, but the effect was menacing. Arresting him is going to cause a scene, Roger. I can assure you that. His parents will be up in arms.
They'll hire lawyers. Mr. McClure will lean on every friend he's got in the department. But it's the right thing to do. And it's your job. Now, if you ever come round here again and ask Stella to lie for you or pretend that boy didn't hurt her, or even suggest she look the other way, I'll be forced to forever equate you with one of those castrated bulls at the back of Dell Chivalry's fields that's so passive and shameful even the kids can't help take a poke at it as they walk by. With that, Carmina closed the door. Leaning back against it, she exhaled. It took me a moment to realize she was shaking. When she caught me staring, she widened her eyes as if to say, "Some people sure have a lot of nerve now, don't they?" I didn't know what to say. "Thank you" seemed like a good start, but I was too much in shock to open my mouth. Part of me wanted to laugh appreciatively at the ballsy way she'd stood up to the officer. Another part wanted to hug her. Maybe even shed tears of gratitude. She had my back. I wasn't alone. At last, I raised an inquiring eyebrow. "Once a cop, always a cop?" "Damn that Roger Perkins," she said. "Sure has a lot of gall." I know it was Trigger who beat me up. I wasn't lying to get him in trouble. "Oh, I know it. Just as surely as I know this is going to direct a heap of ill will our way." I wondered if that's what was really bothering her. The shadow the community would cast over me and her by association. I reminded myself that Thunder Basin was a small, tight-knit community, and one burned bridge was sure to create a lot of smoke. But then she waved herself off and said, "I'm too old to care what the gossips say. Let them take a swing at us. They'll see I don't fall down easily. Something tells me you don't either." I smiled at her, and she smiled back. It softened her face, and for one moment, the cop went out of her, and I saw something in her I hadn't noticed before. She looked kind, tender, almost likable. Despite Carmina's concerns, I insisted on walking to Chet's. I needed the quiet time alone to gather my thoughts. I also had something to prove. I'd spent the past 12 hours playing a reactive role, letting nurses and doctors poke and prod me, allowing Carmina to tuck me in bed and administer my medication, letting him treat me like his personal punching bag. The next 12 hours were going to be very different. I was done sitting back on my heels, letting everyone around me handle the ropes. It was time I took back control, starting with using my own 2 feet to get me where I wanted. I rang Chet's doorbell, and even though I wore dark sunglasses to hide my shiner, I felt self-conscious, nervous. He knew I'd been assaulted, but I wasn't sure Carmina had given him more than the necessary details. I doubted he knew just how bad a shape I was in, and I worried how he'd react when he saw me in the flesh, bruised and battered as it was. Dusty answered the door. I hadn't seen him since that night at the Sundown Diner when the Mustang broke down, but now that I knew he was Chet's brother, it was impossible not to draw comparisons. Dusty was almost as tall as Chet, but lankier, like he hadn't quite filled out yet. He had the same wavy hair, but his fell messily in his eyes and was in need of a good cut. Despite their similarities, Dusty's features were harder and hollower, his eyes closed off and brooding. He slouched his shoulders as if the weight of the world rested on them.
"Yeah?"
he said. He didn't seem to recognize me from the Sundown, and that was okay with me. I didn't know if Chet had told him about me, or disclosed my reasons for being in the Sundown that night, namely to spy on him. But either way, I wasn't going to help Dusty put two and two together. "Is Chet home?"
"Who wants to know?"
"Tell him Stella's here." He scratched the back of his head, eyeing me head to toe. It wasn't a leering examination or meant to intimidate. He seemed to simply be collecting information. For a moment, I thought he might recognize me after all, even with the cuts and bruises. But he finally said,
What's the other guy look like?
Limping, I thought. Definitely limping. Since he took me by surprise and in the dark, I can't really say.
If you're here to settle the score with him, you've got the wrong guy. My brother can't throw a decent punch to save his life, and he'd never smack a girl.
Chet didn't beat me up. I just want to talk.
Talking, on the other hand, Dusty said, shaking his head disgustedly. Now that's something he does very well. You know the nagging teacher in the Charlie Brown movies? Blah, blah, blah. That's my brother. Do this, don't do that, pick up after yourself, get your butt out of bed, don't leave the milk out. Hang on, I'll go get him.
And by go get, he meant turn his head and holler his brother's name loud enough to make my ears ring. With his job completed, Dusty wandered deeper into the house. A moment later, I heard Chet's feet descending the stairs. He came striding down the hall, his hair dripping wet, a dab of shampoo still clinging above his eyebrow. The top snap of his jeans wasn't buttoned, and he wrestled a t-shirt down his torso. He stopped at the sight of me. His eyes drank me in, and they were raw with worry. His gaze flicked over the bruises on my face, and I didn't miss the tightening of his jaw. Lightning quick, his expression darkened with hatred for the person who'd done this to me.
Stella.
Before I could step back or hold my hands up to prevent it, he drew me against him, holding me tightly. I made a soft squeal of protest, and he released me as though he'd been shocked on contact.
Did I hurt you? I didn't even think. I'm sorry.
Not hurt. I smiled to reassure him. They've got me good and drugged. I just wasn't expecting a hug. He plowed a hand through his hair, his eyes assessing me, the line of his mouth grim.
Is that a...
With care, he removed my sunglasses, his mouth compressing tighter at the sight of my blackened eye. And then he swore, softly and with menacing effect. It took me by surprise because I'd never heard Chet curse. I'd never seen him truly angry.
Who did this?
They're investigating.
Did you see him?
Not his face. It was pitch black in the storeroom.
Carmina told me he jumped you at work. Inside the diner where someone should have stopped it from happening. You weren't alone. There were people around. Cooks, dishwashers, your own boss. You weren't in a deserted alley. You were at work.
His blue eyes sizzled with fire.
This never should have happened.
They're going to find him. And when they do, he'll pay.
Who was with you? I want names. I want to talk to every last person who was in the diner last night. Someone knows something.
I couldn't do this. I'd thought I could, but I was wrong. I couldn't relive last night. Not now, when breaking down and losing it were still very real threats. I'd given my statement to Officer Oshiro, and I didn't want to rehash the details with Chet. Not because I didn't care about what he wanted or needed, but for my own sanity. I felt shattered, and I needed to collect the pieces and pull myself together. I wanted to feel strong again.
I didn't want to go back to last night, to feeling helpless and victimized. Not only that, but the violent gleam in Chet's eyes unsettled me.
Payback, it said. He wanted to handle this his way. If I let him, and even if I didn't, he would take this into his own hands. As much as I appreciated and felt flattered by Chet's desire to protect me, this wasn't his fight. Carmina was going to use her weight to try to get Officer Oshiro put back on the case, and the three of us were going to prove Trigger's guilt. There would be no mistakes, no thoughtless screw-ups on our part, and no loopholes for Trigger to escape through. He wouldn't get away with what he'd done. Thank you for the daisies and sunflowers, I told Chet, hoping to defuse his anger. They're beautiful. I can't look at them and not feel cheered up. Chet exhaled, clasped his hands behind his neck, and bowed his head. He rolled his shoulders. He was trying to let go of the rage for my sake, I could tell.
You don't want to talk about it, he said.
His expression was still stony, but the black heat had left his eyes. I don't. Honestly, I want to go for a long drive and not have to think about it. He perked up slightly at the idea of having something to do, at having an outlet for his anger.
Anything. Name it. I'll drive you anywhere.
Take me somewhere without a mirror. I gave a feeble laugh. I'm sick of having to see myself this way. I already asked Carmina to cover my bathroom mirror. If I don't have to look at myself, I can almost forget it happened. There's also that whole vanity issue. I hate feeling ugly. Can you believe I'm worried about that? Chet's cool eyes stared past me out the window.
You'll tell me when they find who did this?
Something in his expression hinted that the fire hadn't completely gone out. It still smoldered under the surface, and despite Dusty's insistence otherwise, I had a feeling Chet was very good at using his hands in a fight. And that's when I saw a glimpse of who he was under that charming boy-next-door exterior. Chet wasn't entirely harmless, and he wouldn't tolerate anyone hurting me. I wasn't going to tell him. I was hardly going to acknowledge it myself. But the fact that he seemed determined to protect me and to right any wrong done to me caused a heat that was equally uninvited and unavoidable to tingle through my body. I didn't know how to respond to his protectiveness. It felt so foreign, this notion of being cared for, that I instinctively rejected it. I swallowed. Thanks, I said softly, reaching for his hand and squeezing it. He studied our laced fingers with a seriousness that made me realize my mistake. I dropped his hand. I started for the front door, and not missing a beat, Chet was at my side.
Here, lean on me, he said, sliding an arm around my waist.
Really, I'm fine, I said. But it felt good to have him close. I'd sworn off any hint of affection between us, but the aftershocks of last night were finally starting to tremble through me. All the fear and helplessness and terror. And I just wanted to let down my guard for one moment. With Chet's arm around me, I felt safe.
How about we drive around the lake, Chet suggested. Or the park. I can grab bread to feed the ducks. Can't think of anything more relaxing than feeding ducks. No mirrors either. Even the pond's too murky to see your reflection.
Can we stop by the library first? If I'm going to be sitting around for the next week or so, I could use a good book. I'd come to Chet's house because I wanted his company and because I wanted to get out of bed and stop feeling sorry for myself. But I'd be lying if I didn't acknowledge that I had an ulterior motive. I didn't want to deceive Chet, but I needed his help with a task, one Carmina couldn't know about. Any guilt I felt over using Chet was overridden by the simple fact that I needed to contact Reed. I'd been in Thunder Basin 2 weeks and hadn't heard from him. Despite my best intentions, I'd only gone back once to check for an email. I didn't like what that said about my priorities. Time to refocus. I had to know he was okay. And we needed to plan how we were going to get back together at the end of summer. Outside, Chet helped me into the scout.
Want the AC on? I think it still works, he said, fiddling with the dials.
No. I surprised myself when I turned down the offer. But the hospital last night had been temperature controlled, artificially chilly, and I didn't want to give my imagination any excuse to revisit that place. I associated it with pain, panic, and weakness. I was done with feeling that way. How's Dusty? I asked.
Chet grimaced. Slept in his own bed last night. It's a start, right?
Any further developments in his plan to strike it rich with Cooter Sagary?
I'm trying to prevent further developments by keeping Dusty too busy to get in trouble. I got him a job plastering swimming pools. He comes home caked in plaster every night, whining about how hard the work is, then inhales half the food in the fridge and crashes in bed. I know he's not sneaking out, because I've set my alarm to go off 4 different times during the night so I can check on him. I told him, if he loses this job, I'll kick him out of the house. I won't. But don't tell him that. He's trying to stay on my good side because until he turns 18, I'm the trustee of the $4,000 my parents left him in their will.
Then you can prevent him from getting this business off the ground. You control the capital.
I can try.
He gave a troubled sigh.
But Dusty's resourceful. If I stonewall him, he'll just find another way. Right now, I'm crossing my fingers he doesn't run out of pool jobs or get fed up and quit before the summer's over. Once he's back in school, it'll be easier to keep Cooter away from him.
I admire how hard you're trying to take care of Dusty. I had dim recollections of my own parents taking a keen interest in me during the divorce. But after the dust cleared and things like alimony and custody had been settled, both had moved on to other interests. Namely, work and drugs. I never visited my dad after he moved out. We'd been estranged for over 2 years. I think I blamed him for the divorce. The sad thing was, I couldn't remember anymore. My mom had a cabinet of prescription pills during the marriage, but segued into heavier drugs after the divorce. Drugs became her top and only priority.
Sometimes I wish my parents were still here, Chet said. They'd know how to help Dusty. He was close to my mom.